Welcome to another edition of No Filter Sports, August 27th, 2020. Eli Zarrett, Bob Page, and Denny McClain. And this is an unprecedented day in sports, an unprecedented era in sports, obviously, with the COVID having, you know, brought the NBA indoors and Major League Baseball with no fans and college football being canceled in two of the major conferences. But now we have a boycott of the NBA playoffs in the bubble, where Milwaukee, before their game five with Orlando yesterday, decided to boycott the game. It was then followed by two other teams, the other games in the entire schedule. When those teams looked ready to bow out, the NBA just canceled the schedule. Some baseball players backed out of playing, including right here in Detroit. Jason Hayward did not play for the Cubs. So this is wild. It's tragic. It's unprecedented, and it's what's going to happen. We're in such a hole here of trying to figure out where we go, what's happening, and what we do about this whole.
Well, let Denny tell you what he just saw on TV as we record this on Thursday morning.
Yeah, Stephen Smith made a statement that he was told off camera that, in fact, they were going to cancel the rest of the season.
NBA canceling the entire rest of the season over this. And by the way, Brandon, as I told you they would be, I saw a blurb today. NBA ratings have been terrible. They've been terrible. And I told you this would affect the NBA. I warned you about this, and you said, oh, no.
And before before we continue with all the elements of this and the complications of all of this, they're doing it with all due respect to everybody, and this is not a disparaging remark, but if they continue to strike, if they continue to boycott, no matter what you want to call it, they're going to hurt their brand, they're going to hurt their product more and more and more. And I don't know how much lower the ratings can get, because they are just awful.
You know, that's such a good point.
They need to do something to promote the game, but if they're not going to play, and I understand the issues, we all do. But the bottom line is, you still have a job. You still have a responsibility. You still got to show up for work.
Denny, you're absolutely right. And I was thinking, because there's so little interest in the season anyway, because of the whole nature of it that we discussed, that who really cares that you're not playing? And can you have that big an influence on America to get anything done by just some basketball players not playing? They do have a powerful forum. They've expressed it as well as they can. This seems to me like a step too far. But, you know, then again, I'm gonna take a devil's advocate position here. You know, Paul George, who plays for the Clippers, came out the other day. He played well in the last game, because the Clippers are supposed to easily dispose of Dallas, and they haven't, especially with the injuries that Dallas has had. But George admitted the anxiety and the depression of living in this bubble, away from family and away from normal life. He needed counseling, and he admitted it. I was at a low ebb. And so I think it's doing a number on
Eli, you know, he went ahead and he said, you know what? The first two games, I was terrible. I was just depressed. I just really wasn't into the first two games at all. You know what I got to say to that? We all have personal problems, but you cannot let them affect your work performance,
Bob.
Especially if you're being paid millions for a seven-month job. Be a pro. Block it out. Just 2 hours, Paul. Block it out for 2 hours, Paul. And then go treat your depression. I understand that. Believe me. But I didn't like what I heard, Eli.
Bob, for somebody like you, who's been on medication for a long time, and you've admitted it, like millions and millions of Americans.
I'll be happy to talk about that with anybody. I don't think we've talked about it on this show, but I have,
yes. A guy like Paul George, who was a great pro, one of the greatest basketball players on the planet, who has overcome all types of adversity in getting to that position and pressure and strain, why won't you take him at his word? Maybe he needs medication and he hasn't had it. But depression is real, as you know. Anxiety is real, as you know. And how can you fault a guy for admitting it? He wants
2 hours. Get your butt out there for 2 hours.
That's so insane.
Okay, fine. Okay, fine, Eli. Then here's what you do. You say, you know what, man? I'm just not into this. I'm just, coach, I can't play, and I can't give a good effort. That's a mental health issue. Yes, fine. Paul, take as much time as you need, buddy. But don't go out there half-assed, half-heartedly when you're getting made millions of dollars to do this.
You know,
Am I right?
The money doesn't matter. The money's got nothing to do with it.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. The money matters. The money matters. Let me tell you why it matters. Like I've always said, you follow the money, you'll follow a solution. And what this is all about, I keep hearing LeBron James say, I'm tired of this. I'm totally tired of this. I need a change. We need a change. Well, they're now talking about going and hiring lobbyists in Washington and attorneys and everything else to take up their case. Here's my question.
What case? Take up what case?
Their case.
Their case for what?
Their case. I'm going to explain it to
Social
you.
Social justice, I think.
Give me 30 seconds.
Oh, okay.
What he wants somebody to do is they want to hire this lobbyist firms and then go to Washington and put their demands up. I haven't heard a demand. I haven't heard what they want. I haven't heard. Listen, let me tell you something real quick, just for the record. There were 370 white people killed by police in 2019. This year, 215 already. Blacks, 235 last year and 111 this year. Those are the real numbers that came right out of the police annals this morning. And you know what? I'm not putting one against the other, not by any stretch, but it just seems to me that we do not talk enough about that.
No, we do. They don't, Denny. I'm with you 100% on this. Now, Jason Whitlock is one of the best known sports columnists in America. He is black. And he is railing against BLM and destroying LeBron James in print, calling him a bigot. I don't agree with everything he writes, of course. But I invite you to go check out Whitlock's columns on a site called OutKick.com. Mm-hmm. New York Post, big story Thursday morning, with video of a white woman in Kenosha, Wisconsin, sobbing uncontrollably as rioters burned down the furniture store she put her heart into for the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. She weeps to reporters, quote, "We didn't do anything to hurt anyone." Kenny Smith walking off the, was that a grandstand move or what? Walking off the set of TNT the other night over the issue. "Kenny, brother, you're from New York. In New York City, where I live half the year, young black men are murdering other black men all the time. How come you haven't been so upset about that and said anything?"
Well, I think they are upset about that. But, you know, let me switch a little bit here, because you're all making good points and I don't dispute any of that. I looked at the video and there's two videos now. There was the first one that one kid named Rayshon White shot. But what to me, this is the bigger issue of incompetence in America. We see incompetence in every facet of what we see, whether it's the cashier, whether it's the insurance agent, whether it's the guy. And anywhere you go, people are either overworked or overmatched. And, you know, what I saw, I'm going to take black and white out of it. Okay.
Good.
I saw three terrified cops doing the wrong thing. And I don't know whether it mattered whether this kid was black or white. They have him on the ground. They fail to handcuff him. They tase him. It still doesn't work. They allow him to get up and walk around the car, and they're trailing behind him with guns loaded, or one cop, as if they're helpless with what to do. He reaches into his car where he may have had a knife, because the kid White who filmed it said, they said, "Don't go for the knife," or "He's picking up a knife." Should they have shot him seven times? No. Should they have let him walk around to his car? No. So it isn't that, from what I saw from the video, it wasn't a case of black and white. It was a case of incompetent people. So it's the competence of the police force, maybe, and they were terrified. These three cops, which means they're either ill-equipped to handle it. Now you got the kid himself, the 29-year-old guy, Jacob Blake. He's 29, and I'm not making a value judgment. He has six children. He's living in that neighborhood. A man cannot support six children who lives in that neighborhood and have a normal life, especially in this day and age.
I think that's non sequitur in this case.
Maybe, really, but cops deal with poor people, and there's all kinds of bad dysfunctional stuff going on. But, you know, we don't know the facts in this case. Now, let's listen to Doc Rivers, okay? No matter how this individual case, whether it's an overreaction by the NBA players or not, this has been called guilty of driving black in America for a long time. Did you see, by the way, what Taylor Decker said when the Lions boycotted practice on Tuesday? Taylor Decker told the story about a guy on the team whose mom calls him every night to make sure that he made the 23-minute drive home from practice safely, because he's from out of state. He has out-of-state plates. He hasn't officially moved to Detroit yet. He's on the team, and he has an out-of-state license, and she's terrified that something will happen on his way home. So it's a whole different dynamic being a white guy in a car and a black guy in a car.
No question.
Doc Rivers, by the way, who didn't say this last night, but two nights ago, in the wake of the Jacob Blake shooting. And by the way, Rivers, as he mentions in his bite, this is a series of bites here. His father was a cop. Let's listen to what Doc Rivers had to say in terms of the mentality of the black man in America.
We're the ones getting killed. We're the ones getting shot. It's amazing why we keep loving this country and this country does not love us back. My dad was a cop. I believe in good cops. We're trying to get them to protect us just like they protect everybody else. All we're asking is you live up to the Constitution. That's all we're asking for everybody, for everyone.
So is it different?
Denny McClain just gave you some figures on this.
I just gave you a number.
I agree.
Doc Rivers is right.
When Doc says
we're the ones who are getting killed, Doc is 100% right. But who's killing them? Who? Young black men are murdering others.
No, Bob. You missed the point here. The men that I just read to you are people that were killed by the police. The whites were killed by the police, and the blacks were killed by the police.
Yeah. Okay. Fine.
Let's not take the inner city crime. Okay.
But gentlemen, listen. We have an epidemic in this country of guns. No question. And when you hear that 600 people got killed last year, with plus another 158, by the way, of Latinos got killed.
Where? So,
you're talking 1,200 within 12 months of whites, blacks, and Latinos got killed by police. That's an epidemic, guys.
But usually, Denny, you see these videos, some guy's doing something. Mm-hmm. He's not just blowing bubbles in a park. And the police say, excuse me, sir, guy's got a weapon. The police officers invariably say, sir, drop your weapon, drop your weapon. Not only do they not drop the weapon, frequently they will point it at police and sometimes shoot at police. Big issue here.
Well, I could tell you this.
It happens on both sides is what
right.
Danny.
I've had uncles on the
guys
Chicago
get killed
police.
Too.
Mm-hmm. I've had three, four uncles on the Chicago police force for years. I've got dear friends on the Chicago police force right now. I know a lot of those guys down there. And I'll tell you, they too talk about the epidemic of guns. But mm-hmm. I think it's a little bit different for them to talk about it because they have to go out there every day and they might have to face guns every time they stop somebody or go into somebody's house. And that too is just too much. The cops busting into the wrong homes recently. It's an epidemic. I don't want to be a cop in a major city anymore.
My wife, her first husband was an Oakland County sheriff, and he was shot when he was went to investigate a McDonald's being ripped off. And I don't know whether he was a racist when he was born. I didn't know him very well, but when you deal as a cop in poor neighborhoods, you get a real chip on your shoulder, a real fear and a real lack of respect for the people there. And it's a difficult situation. I'm going to change the subject just a little bit here. You can get back.
No, we got a lot more on this. Okay. What do you want to mention?
I want to mention that I watched Real Sports, and I've said it many times. This is the best investigative sports show we have, at least video version. And they did a feature on Bruce Maxwell. You know who Bruce Maxwell is? Bruce Maxwell is the Oakland A's catcher who, after Kaepernick, by the way, 4 years ago today or yesterday, that Kaepernick knelt for the first time. Bruce Maxwell was the Oakland A's catcher who then knelt, the only baseball player who knelt. He's a black kid who suffered prejudice all his life. He's half and half from he was a little kid, grown men yelling the N-word at him from the stands and everything. And he just felt the sense of solidarity, knelt, and his life was turned into a living hell. He was scared for his life. So it's different. This sounds cliche. It's different being black. And so, yes, I agree with you. I believe the NBA has overreacted to this. The players have. I agree with Denny 100%. Not that many people care about what you're doing right now. Do your job and do the social activism another time. Don't screw up the season, etc. But if you watch this story, you will see the mentality that creates the paranoia and the looking over your shoulder and the fear that black folks feel about police and white folks don't.
Okay, now I want you to listen to this.
Go ahead,
Bob. Because this is the antidote to what's going on in the NBA. Before game 3 of the Tampa-Boston series Wednesday night, Video screens in the Toronto arena where the NHL games are being played had large graphics that read, "End racism." The public address announcer, empty arena, we know, but he came on TV and he said, and I'm quoting, "Racism has been embedded in our society for far too long. Today and every day, the NHL and the hockey community are committed in the mission to combat racial injustice and achieve a fair society for all. The NHL would like to take this moment to wish Jacob Blake and his family well and call out to our fans and communities to stand up for social justice and the effort to end racism." End of the announcement. Then 7 seconds of silence. Classy? You better believe it.
Yes.
The right thing to do? Yeah. You better believe that. But as Honest Abe once said, you can't please all the people all the time. So they go to the studio and here's former Islanders goaltender Kelly Rudy on Sportsnet in Canada saying, you know, "I don't think we should be here. I think the NHL should postpone the games. We're wrong to be playing out here." Minnesota Wild defenseman Matt Dumba, who's a founding member of the player-based Hockey Diversity Alliance, knew about the NHL's pre-games plans and still said he was disheartened by what the league and the players did in playing. And Boston's great defenseman Zane Ochara said afterwards, "Where's the effect? I mean, what do you guys want? We just got to the arena. We knew nothing about anybody not playing in other sports or anything like that. We just didn't have enough sufficient time to discuss following suit." But I think the NHL's handled this well. I really do.
Yeah. And
I'm going to share one story. And I've told this story a little bit in the past with Willie Horton, Gates Brown, and some of the black guys. When I first got into professional baseball and I was in minor leagues a little less than a year, they sent me to Knoxville, Tennessee, as a matter of fact, where I am today. And the first thing that we did, we stopped at a black rooming house, which I didn't know. I'd never seen it before coming out of Chicago. And the black guys had to get off the bus and go into the black rooming house, and they were fed and clothed and bedded there. And then we would see them at night. The same night, Willie Horton is hitting. And the first time up, the guy struck him out. The second time up, Willie hits a home run. The third time up, Willie almost gets his head taken off with this guy, puts the bat up, and he hits about a 10-foot pop-up to the pitcher. And the pitcher starts laughing. And I don't think he was laughing at Willie. It just was a very funny thing. I think everybody in the bench was laughing, too. Well, because he was laughing and Willie then charged the pitcher, they threw him out of the ballgame. And at that time, the clubhouse was way behind the fences. So he had to go run across the infield, go out the third base dugout and run up the hill to get to the clubhouse. He gets all the way up there. And I was dressed in dress clothes that day because I was pitching the next day. And the manager sent me to make sure Willie was okay. He gets to the locker room and there's a big chain across the door. Willie ripped the door open and the chain busted. He went into the locker room. He grabbed a bat and started destroying every damn locker there was in the locker room. I mean, he was just Mr. Crush. Well, guess, and I turned around just for a second because I thought I heard people outside the door. And lo and behold, it was three cops. Two of them had guns drawn. And I said, "What are you guys going to do? Come on now. He's just having a temper tantrum. He'll be fine." He says, "If he comes out of there with that baseball bat, he won't be fine." And I talked Willie down at least with the bat. And, I saw it 60 years ago. And you know what? Based upon the numbers I just read, guys, it's gotten worse.
Oh, well, no kidding. That was getting worse is another story.
Well, I don't agree with that. It's getting worse. You know, 60 years ago, things really were much worse.
There is paranoia. White cops are scared of black guys and what they're going to encounter. Here's a story. I went to an interracial camp when I was 13. My parents were very much into
you mean, you mean you were the only Jew with a bunch of white guys from Westchester County?
No, it was about half. It was about a third racially integrated. And two-thirds white. But when I was working at DFN downtown, I stopped at Jefferson to get a Detroit News or a Free Press it was pitch dark in the morning, 5 o'clock. I get it. And as I get, two black guys are walking down Jefferson. So what am I thinking? Do they know that I went to an interracial camp? Do they know that I worked at JZZ? Do they know who my black friends are?
You didn't cross the street.
I'm scared.
Did you?
I'm scared. You know what they walk by. You know what they say? Have a blessed day.
that's a good sign. You and I both worked for a great guy who unfortunately passed away a long time ago named Herman Haynes. He was the black guy who was a program director at WJZZ.
Work for Herman?
I did. Anyway, so Herman and I are having a big discussion about this one day. He says, "Bob, I got to be honest with you. If I'm walking down the street and I see three black guys walking toward me, I'm on the other side of that street real fast. No person in human history has ever said, uh-oh, here come three Jews walking down the street. I better get over to the other side right now.
That guy with the
Am I right?
Whatever. Hey, listen, Dr. Yaldo is open again. He's doing more business. He's giving people LASIK surgery, changing their lives, letting them have better than 20/20 vision without glasses and contacts. Why don't you just make that call? You don't need to have bad vision. You don't need to deal with ancient technology where you got to put contacts in your eyes and poke yourself a couple times a day and change your prescription every 6 months or a year with glasses. This is not hype. Not just LASIK surgery for those under 45, but if you're over 45, like everybody listening to this show, find out about multifocal lens exchange. You will see the microscopic print without reading glasses. Your far vision will be high def HD. Just go check it out. You don't need to suffer or settle for bad vision. Get a free evaluation. Find out which procedure will change your life in ways only you can imagine. Call 1-800-398-EYES or go to YaldoEyeCenter.com. Tell them No Filter Sports sent you for special discounts. Hey, and everybody knows Lincoln's legacy of luxury cars. You buy a Lincoln, you demand, and you get both a great buying experience and a service element also that is unequaled. It's why Hoot McInerney Star Lincoln leads the field with a premier Lincoln dealership in Detroit, an exemplary family business started by Hoot, the legendary auto giant and philanthropist. In July alone, Star got nearly 100 five-star reviews for the 100 vehicles they sold. A woman wrote, "My entire experience was more than wonderful." So I've gotten 6 cars from Star. They are Detroit's premier Lincoln dealership. Call them. Make an appointment at 248-354-4900. See what kind of service you get, or you can buy effortlessly online at starlincoln.com. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Well, do we move on from this topic and go to the...
Yeah, what do we talk about? I got some stuff, and Danny does too, and I know you do too, and Brandon does too, on the Tigers and what's been going on. They just took 2 out of 3 from the Cubs after winning 2 out of 3 at Cleveland, believe it or not. Opened a series Thursday night against the Minnesota Twins. Boys, where do you want to go with this? You want to take it chronologically Monday night, then Tuesday night, then Wednesday night? Well, if you want to take it Monday night, let's start with Casey Mize's second major league start.
Yeah, let's do that. Even Jack Morris finally saw it. He made the statement the other night. If he doesn't start throwing more fastballs, he'll never set up the other pitches. You cannot set up a changeup with another changeup. You cannot set up a curveball with another curveball. You got to set it up with a better pitch all the time, whether it's a strike or not. And he doesn't understand it. Nobody on that ball club, I swear, knows what pitching is all about. There is a philosophy and a science to it. And nobody wants to show this kid what to do. It was real easy to get these little kids out in college. I mean, any little curveball, any little swerve or curve or whatever you want to call it, will get a guy out in college and high school. Bottom line, the guy has to throw more fastballs, get back in the game, and I hope the guy hasn't lost much confidence. But man, I'll tell you one thing. They really hit some long home runs off him. It reminds me of me too much.
What? Fastball is the easiest pitch to throw for a strike.
Not necessarily, but yeah.
Isn't it?
Most of the time,
I would think, why would you throw less fastballs than more? Unless you have a
lot. Throwing 102, that's why. Some guys just don't have that great.
But he's throwing 92, 93. Listen, all we heard was what great control this kid hit. He had great control the other day. Every pitch he threw, for God's sakes, was almost belt high down the middle of the plate. And if you don't believe it, look at the video.
Here's my thing about Casey Mize, guys. If you look back at recent baseball history and some of the debuts that big ballyhooed young pitchers made, remember the first time you ever saw JV? How about Steven Strasburg? How about Aroldis Chapman? You went, wow! The thing with Casey Mize is, to me, there is no wow factor watching this, which is not to say he can't become a great pitcher. And I'm listening to Denny McClain talk about this, and the problem with that, as great as Denny McClain was as a pitcher, there are a lot of ex-major league pitchers, and a lot of you guys have different philosophies about pitching. So I don't know where Casey Mize is.
Casey Mize the number one pick? What is it about him that made him the best?
He struck out a lot of guys in college. He won almost every ball game he played, but now I know why. He threw nothing but curveballs and sliders to these guys in the changeup, the forkball. So, I mean, in college, that's an easy thing to do.
I would think that'd be an easy thing to spot in scouting. Wouldn't you?
I can't get over it. I really can't. And he does throw 92, 93 miles an hour. I mean, that's a good
fastball.
That's
not a great major league baseball.
Well, I'll tell you
fast.
One thing.
It's
he's
not.
He's got one real good pitch, and why he doesn't throw it more, I don't understand. That little three-quarter fastball he throws, it tails back into a right-handed hitter. That is a good pitch, and he's going to have to make that be his number one pitch to set up some of the other pitches. But that's a good one, boy. Some of those sinkers that he threw, they dropped 6-8 inches. I mean, it was great stuff. But But
I like
the other
his stuff.
Thing, he didn't
I like
throw very
stuff.
Many for strikes.
Yeah, I really do. You guys, speaking of pitchers, you remember Jim Deshays? I bet you do. Right. Yeah. So Jim is the Chicago Cubs color commentator. I watched the Cubs broadcast Monday and Wednesday night. And God, what a breath of fresh air. Of course, they're homers, but they're not like the Tigers homers. They're in, and they don't talk as much. They don't talk as much in the
no,
booth.
No, they let them play the game.
You know who the Chicago Cubs play-by-play is? His name is Len Casper. He grew up in Mount Pleasant, Michigan, a wacko Tigers fan. He idolized Ernie Harwell and Paul Carey, and he talked about them a lot on the broadcast Monday night. He also talked about Denny's fellow Chicago native, Kyle Funkhauser, the Tigers pitcher. You know, this is an interesting story, which I hadn't heard. He comes from a blue-collar background in Chicago. Not one person in Funkhauser's family had ever gone to college. He got a scholarship to pitch for Louisville. The Dodgers offered him $2 million to turn pro. He said, no, I'm going to be the first person in my family's history to graduate from college. How about that?
How about another pitching uplifting story? Tonight, they open a series with Minnesota. Boyd's 0-4. He goes for his first win, but he's pitching. It's Randy Dobnak. Now, Randy Dobnak is the guy that Jim Essien mentioned when we had him on his show.
Yeah.
Essien developed him. For the Utica Unicorns over in Andy Appleby's league there, the United Shore League. So he goes from Utica, where it's minor league baseball at kind of the lowest level, to now pitching for the Minnesota Twins and doing very, very well. So that's a good story. Now, you talked about the Chicago Cub announcement.
So what, by the way, what are we supposed to do tonight then? We record this again on Thursday. I mean, I guess you want the Tigers to win. You hope
pitch
as well. How do you root against this kid from Minnesota?
I don't root. I just watch. But you talk about the Cubs announcers. We have Matt Shepard, who makes home run calls that are just epic. And the other night when Jonathan Scope, our exciting heavy-hitting second baseman at Grand Slam, listen to a classic home run call.
2-1, belted, deep left, get out of here. See ya! Grand Slam for Jonathan Scope. What a night for the Tigers!
Oh, go ahead and say what you just said. Say what you just said to us when off mic
I forget what I
Tell
said.
Us what you were saying about Matt Shepard and how embarrassed you were for the guy.
Well, he's a little corny. That's all. I like Matt, and I don't want to knock him.
I'm sure he's a nice. I mean, I've only met him once or twice.
I just play the home run calls and let them stand.
Yeah, but
you're not taking any responsibility for the comment. Huh?
I'm not gonna knock him. Matt Shepard's one of the hardest working sportscasters ever in this market.
I know that.
And he deserved what?
He's way over the top. I mean, Jack should slap him in the back of the head or something and just say, hey, listen, you got to calm down. Don't pee in your pants every time somebody hits a home run. Yeah. I mean,
Know, when I was a boy growing up in Detroit, my buddies and I, we'd be out playing baseball or playing basketball in the backyard, and we would imitate certain Detroit announcers, Van Patrick, anybody you want, and we would be laughing at them. We thought they were like hysterical, ridiculous. I was not one of those guys who grew up dreaming of being a play-by-play announcer. I never wanted to be a P-by-P guy, but people like Matt Shepard and Mario Impemba do. And when they're lucky enough to get the amazing job of broadcasting the Tigers games in their own hometown, they want to shill and they want to keep that job. And that's just what Matt Shepard's doing right now. It's pretty transparent.
Right. I mean, I did that myself. And you didn't laugh at me, but you asked me how I could possibly do it, because I did that for the Pistons for several years. I was essentially a PR man. Now, they were very, very good. It's easy to be a PR man when you're good.
Yeah.
When you're not very good and you got to pump guys up and make it sound like everything is hunky-dory, that's when you say it feel a little dirty. On the other hand,
if you're going to start ripping the team, you're not going to work very long for them either. So you got to play it. If you can't play it down the middle, you play it with the best side to keep your check.
Yeah, well, the Tigers are 13-16, having won 3 out of 4 now.
Wow.
They're out of the playoff field, so it's not. But here's the thing. Tonight's game is the midway point of the season.
I know. You know what Deshay said Wednesday night about that? They brought that up during the Cubs broadcast. He said, hey, what do you know? It's the All-Star break.
Now, check out the Dodgers. The Dodgers, of course, didn't play last night because they boycotted their game against the Giants.
Yeah, they're Mookie Betts.
Stop saying last night. Damn it, it's Wednesday night. People are going to be listening to the show for the next week.
Pardon me, Wednesday night. Dodgers are 22-8 on a pace to win 119 games. Did you see the no-hitter the other night that Lewis Giolito threw?
Man, he's got great. I mean, we saw it when we
Lucas
played
Giolito
recently, but man, he's got great stuff.
Yeah.
Of course, when he lets the ball go, he's like only 40 feet for God's sake from home plate.
And since we're talking about these other teams and other guys, and Brandon being the baseball fantasy player he is going to just eat this stuff up. Brandon and everybody else already anointed the New York Yankees 2020 World Series champions. So Aaron Judge has been out with an injury.
Again.
He comes back Wednesday night. Aaron Judge comes back Wednesday night, and he re-injures it on the first game. Gerrit Cole lit up by the Braves Wednesday night. Yankees swept in a doubleheader. He had an angry confrontation last week with manager Aaron Boone when Booney came out and pulled him out of the game. Cole thought too early. Now listen to this. Giancarlo Stanton has also been out. DJ LeMahieu out of Birmingham Brother Rice, the Yankees' best all-around hitter, out. Gleyber Torres, out. Number two starter Paxton, out. Starter Luis Severiano out for 60 days, and standout reliever Zach Britton
is also not as bad as Tampa Bay. I mean, they've got 9 pitchers on the DL. 9 pitchers on the DL. Well, 9.
Here's your stat. In 2018, at 31 games into the season, there were 43 pitchers on the injured list. 2019, 51, pretty soon. Now there's 98, so double. And that doesn't include 20 for the coronavirus.
What we should Tigers do is use 91. Tigers used 91 on Wednesday night, didn't they?
You know what we should do next year? You know what the team should do next year? Have 3 spring trainings and see how many more we can hurt. Spring training, you're going to have more and more of this.
Yeah, well, it's back in the old days when you played, the players didn't work out in the off season, but
not necessarily true. We didn't work out the way these guys do because we could not afford to hire a trainer and whatever else you need to work out every day. But we worked out in one form or another, you know, and certainly you watched your diet and what have you. And before you did go to spring training, you threw a little bit, 2-3 weeks ahead of time. And by the time you got there, at least you could throw BP. So, yeah, we worked out a little bit more than what you believe.
Right. You say you watched your diet. Yeah. How many cases of Pepsi did you drink in a week? Cases. Four or five.
With the FBI?
That's my sugar.
I used to drink almost a case a day. A case, 24.
Well, you know, when Denny and I did the show together in the early 90s, the Eli and Denny show, which he wanted to be called the Denny and Eli show, but he lost that in the beginning. we would drive to do interviews and stuff, and he would take a traveler, but he didn't just take a traveler. He would take 2 Diet Cokes to make a 20-minute drive. Not 1, 2.
I love that term. You guys remember Don Lark? Real handsome guy.
Yeah,
he's a news anchor,
Channel 7. Right?
So I worked with Lark, and we would anchor the Saturday night news together, and he'd say, Bobby, you want to go out? I said, yeah, I'll get one. He said, want to stop by his house first. He says, I got to get a traveler. I said, a traveler? He'd go in and pour himself a drink, put it in a cup between his legs, and he'd be driving us out to the bar. And he'd always kept his TV makeup on, and he kept his Channel 7 button on, his suit and tie. Sure. We walked in. Lark was a classic, but he was a hell of an anchorman. Bonds Jr.
How about Vince Wade? Did you ever hang out with Vince Wade?
I knew Vince, but no.
Vince is the same thing. Yeah. He would keep the makeup on, keep his Channel 7 pin.
Hey, girls, here I am.
Like we discussed the other day, there's only one Bill Bonds.
I'd say Vince, true. You know, you're kind of taking a chance as a married man. He goes, I'm a married man, but I'm not fanatical about it.
And by the way, Danny, I do want to say something about that because Rich Fisher is just one of the best guys you'd ever meet.
Great guy. In history.
And he was almost a Bonds clone. He idolized Bill. Right. Rich Fisher was tremendous. He was as near to a Bill Bonds as you could get, and he died way too young.
Oh, I visited him in the last few days. I mean, I've never seen anything so sad in my life. Yep. He was down like 130 pounds.
God.
Good-looking guy, sweetest
man,
guy.
Man, he went quick. Boy, oh boy.
Man.
Well, anyway, so you guys mentioned through Matt, thank you so much, Matt, the Grand Slam that was hit the other night, and I'm begging the Tigers to sign this guy, sign Jonathan Scope. He's going to be a free agent at year's end. Now, on the show the other day, I said that we'd seen enough of Joe Jimenez as the closer, and he needs to go to Toledo right now and make Soto the closer. Wednesday night, they bring him in anyway. In the sixth, though, he's not the closer anymore. 2-1 Cubs lead. This guy had an ERA of 12.46 coming into Wednesday's game, and he gave up immediately a home run to Kyle Schwarber, okay? Then you look at what is going on with some of these other guys in the bullpen. You look at Buck Farmer, who's now back. Remember, they had Buck Farmer and Drew Verhagen, almost clones of each other, big 6'5 right-handers who threw 95 miles an hour. While Verhagen is now in Japan, did you know that? That's where he's playing right now because he wasn't good enough. Farmer is now throwing his fastball, Denny, 92-93. He was 95-96 before, and you wonder why he almost blew the game, giving up three runs in the ninth inning on Wednesday night. And I want to say another thing for you to comment on. I don't know who this guy is, but Jose Cisnero is real good.
He's good. Yeah, he's good. Ryan Garcia looked good last night. Norris looked good. They have some pitchers that look okay.
Pretty good arm. The thing, listen, I want to let you know, when they throw guys in the middle of the game and they got a game that's going on like they had last night, they're showcasing these guys to try to make a trade and to try to get something of value if there is something out there that they can do. I don't know if the Tigers are going to be active in another couple of days because the trading deadline's coming up. And I don't August think 31st, they will. Yeah. I think they're scared to death to make a deal because they made so many bad deals the last number of years.
But Denny, the Cubs announcers were laughing almost at the Tigers last night. The team coming in, the starting pitchers for Detroit, had a combined ERA of 7.25.
Yeah.
Who wants to make a deal for guys with ERAs of 12.46?
Well, maybe somebody sees something that one of these kids are doing that can be fixed, can be corrected. That's all I can tell you. I mean, we've seen this happen with, when we've let some other guys go, and of course, vice versa. Other teams have done the same thing with other teams. But bottom line is, they're showcasing some guys right now, and it's going to be interesting to see if they do anything by the trading deadline. I doubt it.
I want to tell you, and we'll talk about it in a moment here, about our guest today. Because we have an amazing guest today who has written one of the greatest sports books I have ever read. I'm going to tell you about that in a moment. First, I want to tell you that Luke Nowacki of Pinnacle Wealth Strategies, longtime Red Shovel Network supporter of our show and others, serves so many of our listeners by creating financial plans, business plans, trust, whatever. Whether it's future family obligations, maybe your retirement, just let Luke develop a comprehensive plan for you. Decades of experience, track record of success for individuals and businesses. So if you call Luke at 248-663-4748, he'll set up a complimentary consultation. You'll fire away with all manner of information. You'll get asked your questions, and Luke will lay out a plan that fits your individual needs. You can take it or leave it. I think you'll take it because he is ethical, knowledgeable, and caring. Luke Nowacki, Pinnacle Wealth Strategies. Call 248-663-4748. And Hall Financial, I mean, these rates for interest now are dramatic, dramatic lows, record-setting lows. So take advantage of this time to refinance your home. Can't do better than doing it with David Hall Mortgage. Been in our community over three decades, built his business, maintained leadership in the mortgage market by consistently offering better options, more personal attention, and thousands of the most satisfied clients. They've also sustained their leadership with the fastest service in the business, generally 3 weeks or less. Mine was less than that. Don't know how much less. It happened really quickly. I know that. That's why he's got nearly 1,500 five-star reviews for Michigan homeowners. Go to davidhallmortgage.com, get started, or call 248-308-5000. Hall Financial, lower payments, better options, more personal attention. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. And Bob, you set this up with the publishing house of Stu Grimson's book. It's called Stu Grimson, The Grim Reaper. And before you say anything about this, I don't read much about hockey. I read the Ken Dryden book on Scotty Bowman. In 10 pages in this book, his description of Scotty Bowman is, the stories in this book are so good. And he only spent 2 years here with the Red Wings in 95 and 96. He's got so many great stories. I couldn't put the book down.
So many bad stories. It's the greatest hockey book I've ever read in my life. And I totally agree with you. It's one of the best sports books I've ever read in my life.
And you know, he's an enforcer and a classic enforcer. And you look at, and when we bring him on, I'm going to play some of his fights. He would look like the biggest goon, lunatic, angry, crazy man out there. And yet he's a bright, sensitive. The art of being an enforcer has never been described like this. The mentality, the anxiety, the fear, what it takes, whether it's Probert or McSorley or him, or that when he fought Dave Brown the first time and had his face broken apart.
No, you know, he knocked Brown out the first time they fought, and Brown was pissed. So yeah. Brown really went after him the second time, and that's when he utterly destroyed Stu Grimson's face.
Yeah, there's the stories with Pro. Anyway, we're going to talk to Stu Grimson coming up a little bit later.
I got a good story for you here, guys.
Go ahead.
Okay. I happened to be on the phone with our mutual good friend the other day, Larry Sorensen, the former University of Michigan standout from Mount Clemens, who pitched so many years in Major League Baseball, and a former guest on our show, of course, and we'll be hearing from Larry again in the future. So it's just in the course of a long conversation, I had to ask him about the University of Michigan sex abuse scandal. And I said, did this guy examine you, this creep Anderson? He said, sure, he examined me. So I had mentioned before on this program that it seems as though this guy Anderson had a thing mainly for black athletes, and Eli quickly poo-pooed me, saying most of the athletes at Michigan are black. Eli, that ain't true in baseball. Larry said Anderson did give him an obviously unnecessary digital rectal exam, but he didn't think anything about it. It's not sexual abuse. What? It never even dawned on him that could be sexual abuse. So we were talking about another issue that we broached here. Does a digital rectal exam on a person who shouldn't have one in and of itself constitute sexual abuse? And how many guys now, if any, might be just trying to get on the gravy train, you know, a little down on their luck financially and say, I could make some money out of this.
Well, but you know what? I mean, that happens in every kind of, great, big, huge lawsuit. You're going to have a whole bunch of people filing claims and trying to come up with stories that make sense. I mean, that's just a part of it, the legal system.
You know, what's interesting is that, and I agree with that, because I asked that on the last show, is it takes 5 seconds. I wasn't very comfortable. I've gotten many because of, when you get to 50, I got to start getting them. I don't enjoy them, but it wasn't painful. And I don't like the thought of it, but it didn't cause me any trauma. But when the whole story broke was about Chuck Christian, who is dying of prostate cancer. And he said he felt tremendous pain when Anderson did. So maybe because he later had prostate cancer, he genuinely had a problem. And it's too bad that Anderson missed it. Because it's not painful. It can be a little uncomfortable. It's not painful. And so,
well,
yeah,
I don't know that either. What they're checking for, because we've all been through this, is just to see how enlarged your prostate gland actually is. And then if they think there's a problem with it, they're going to biopsy it. I have had that done to me, and it came back negative, of course, fortunately. But so, yeah, I mean, there's so many issues, ancillary issues about this.
Yeah. Football is obviously, basketball is in doubt now.
Well, let me ask you a question. You think the NFL is going to play?
Yes.
I'm anxious to see what they're going to do based upon what just happened yesterday and today. And if the NBA is not going to play, does the NFL then decide, well, if they're not going to play, we're not going to play?
I think maybe that this whole thing last night, Wednesday night, with all the cancellation, don't forget that Kenosha is near Milwaukee.
Yes, it is.
Milwaukee is the team. And that maybe if they're stuck in the bubble, they're depressed. Everything that's negative in your life when you're depressed seems all the more worse. They don't want to be there, obviously. These players have been there for too long. It could be a combination of events. And if they weren't in the bubble, if it was a regular, if we didn't have COVID and all this, maybe this would not have happened. So the extremism everywhere is so frightening in America. Extremism in every aspect of our life, it seems, that maybe this was just a real, the perfect storm to make this happen.
You looked at, do you see what this clown, which is what he is, I'm really not into far right wing or far left wing people.
Who, Bob?
The ex-Tiger, Aubrey Huff. Did you see what he said yesterday?
I don't care what he says. He's a lunatic. What did
he went public lauding this white kid who just killed two people with his rifle.
Oh my God!
Let's not talk about this. Let's not even talk about this. That's Aubrey Huff.
But Eli, you broached the issue, and you're totally right in doing so. Because we're so polarized in this country right now, and as opposed to the Nixon years, which we all lived through, now we've added another thing: religion, which has also polarized us further. You take a look at everything that's going down now, and it's, you know, we're not getting along, a lot of us, and could we be? This is this classic stuff that foments civil wars. We're lucky we've existed this long as a nation.
Yeah, maybe so.
Let me give you a good story. I predicted last week Phil Mickelson, who went on the Champions Tour, who are the seniors, right? Phil Mickelson. I can't say it. Let me move my teeth. Phil Mickelson went out and played in his first Champions golf tournament the other day, and guess what he did?
He kicked ass.
Based upon my prediction, he won. And but you know what? He'll win 10 times the first year he's out there.
Damn right. Right. They go on as seniors, and they beat everybody for the first two or three years.
Absolutely.
When you join the PGA Tour, you're 22 years old, and it takes you some years to learn how to win. This is the opposite. When you join the seniors tour, you've already learned how to win. You're an accomplished golfer and the youngest guy out there. It makes sense. The courses are set up easier. They're shorter. You're going to win. It's just a goofy sport, and it's the only sport that really – well, I guess there's other sports that have seniors. You got seniors in tennis.
But, you know, think about it. 50 years old, coming out winning $1.2 million.
That's not too bad. Just to play golf, which you do anyway.
And it's this good is walking what around, money boy.
This is what slays me about the opening every year on the PGA Tour. They play the first two events, as you know, in Hawaii.
Yeah,
hey, fellas, how about an all-expenses-paid trip in January for two to go to Hawaii and play golf on these amazing courses on the ocean and maybe win a lot of money?
I'm sorry.
I don't think so. Yeah,
The expenses, Bob? I'm sorry. Who pays the expenses?
Well, of course, they have sponsors. And then, of course,
the players pay the expenses.
I would think they might be able to afford to go to Hawaii for 4 days of free golf on two
I understand
of the
what you're saying.
We know what you're
but
saying.
But you're wrong. The players pay their own expenses.
That's they do. Okay, get past that then.
By the way,
that's what you said. I'm just repeating what you said. All expenses.
But that's a minor part of the issue. That's not the main point.
On the PGA Tour, in most cases, they fly now from obviously from tournament to tournament, but now they charter a big plane, and those who want to get on it go. Those who have their own plane go their own thing. Uh-huh. But they do that now. When the tournament's over on Sunday, they all get on a plane after being tested for COVID on Monday, and they go to the next city.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Treated very well.
Is that in part a backlash to the horrible, tragic thing that happened to Payne Stewart?
Not at all.
I don't think
on a little private plane.
That was just.
They don't want
them
to take little private planes.
No. That was a Learjet. That was a Learjet. That wasn't a little plane.
It's all COVID. It's all COVID. Defending against COVID.
Hey, Eli, I got a question for you.
Go ahead.
What did happen on this day in sports?
Oh well, glad you asked. I said earlier, Colin Kaepernick did his kneeling thing that is we never could have imagined it would get this far. And as Denny said the other day, Roger Goodell said, "I wish I'd listened more to Kaepernick back then. Maybe a lot of this would have been avoided. I don't know." First Major League Baseball telecast. Of course, nobody's watching because nobody had TVs. But that was back in 1939 when the Reds beat the Dodgers at Ebbets Field. Let's see. Burger King bought Tim Hortons for $11.4 billion on this day in 2014. I was involved
in a whole Twitter thing with people the other day. I said, so many Americans are so ignorant about hockey. They know everybody knows what Tim Hortons donuts is. I have no idea that Tim Horton was a real person. I watched him play for the Leafs on Hockey Night in Canada the entire time. He was a hero. He was a god to us. And Timmy, unfortunately, you know, after he got into the donut business, he was killed in a car crash at age 44. Yeah. So it's a terrible thing.
Ricky Henderson stole his 119th base on this day in 1982.
Yeah, sure he did. Don't get me going on that, boy.
Anyway,
that is leading to, Eli, is was that in an 8-1 game or
a lot of empty steals, like empty steals.
More than 50% of his steals were steals that weren't even had no value at all. None up by 5, 6, 7.
All
eight,
I remember
runs.
Is him raising the base and saying, "I am the greatest."
The greatest.
But we all know that Eli's hero, Muhammad Ali, was actually the greatest because he said so.
But by the way, in the last 10 years, because I know Brandon is very much into steel, the fact that steals are a lost art in baseball.
What? You said Brandon's into stealing?
Yeah, yes, into the lack of stealing.
I love the young guy. I don't want him in jail. What's he stealing?
The last 10 years, the most steals in the season has been 68, so it shows that's barely half of what Ricky did by Juan Pierre in 2010. Last year, leading steals was Ronald Acuna, 37, Malik Smith, 46. So the only man to steal 100 bases since Ricky is?
Maury Wills.
Nope, that was before.
Ooh. Is it Ron?
Since Ricky.
Since Ricky. Was Vince Coleman did it three times.
But I didn't know that.
Our guy Ron LaFleur, who we had on, and by the way, Adam, whatever his name is writing a book with Ron LaFleur now after having heard him on our show. They're doing a lot of interviews, and Ron is really? Going to get another book written on him by one of our listeners. Very, very nice to have been able to be the intermediary on that. But LaFleur had 97 for Montreal and 80, and only Coleman and Ricky stole more since that time. That's about it.
I called Dick Williams up once, and I didn't ask him about Ron LaFleur, and he says, sure can run. Yeah. I said, yeah, but boy, he can get on base. He can hit. Dick Williams says, sure can run.
Well, let me give you a little bit of entertainment news. I got a call yesterday from the Mantle family, Mickey Mantle family. You want to read the commercials first?
No. I just got to say, I got to say goodbye to our radio listeners, WCWA. Thanks for listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. You want to hear Stu Grimson, you should download the show at nofiltersports.com. You have been listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Go ahead, Danny.
Now, the Mickey Mantle family, I got a call yesterday from David and one of the sons. And what they're getting ready to do is to launch a 20-part series on the life of Mickey Mantle. They're in the process of taping it now and videotaping it, and I'm going to be one of their guys that's going to be in it, just telling a home run story. That's what I'm going to probably
do. The guy who contacted our show, and
he called you first.
I don't think a network has taken it yet, so he's doing it on spec for the Mantle family. We'll see if it turns into anything on TV that may remain.
Well, they got a commitment. I'm pretty sure they got the commitment based upon the conversation I had, but we'll see. You know what? It's got to be, if nothing else, until the end of the movie, it'll be very funny because the guy was involved in everything cute that ever happened on that ball club.
Oh, I know. Matt Mantle was an amazing life and career.
You're not going to do any. You're not going to do any nude scenes in the movie, are you?
Well, you know, you never know. Stop.
I don't think I'm going to be able to see it if you do.
Is 20 part too long? That seems really long. People were complaining about a 10 part one about the Bulls.
Well they're only five. He did play 19 years.
Brandon, they're only 10 minutes, so it's going to be six per hour. It's going to be three and a half hours. I'm just kidding. I have no idea. On this day, Dino Cicerelli traded by the Wings to the Tampa Bay Lightning. That was in 1996. And it's interesting because our guest coming up, Stu Grimson, was traded very early in the season in 97. He missed out on the Wings Stanley Cups also. That's about it. Braves sell Johnny Sain to the Yankees for $50,000 in 51, and this is the day that Boston signed free agent outfielder Ken Harrelson for $75,000. That kind of precipitated the free agent movement that came later on.
That's not $75,000 a game as it is now. Yeah, right. It's $75,000 a year.
I'll tell you what I just saw on ESPN a second ago, that the players are leaning to playing now. So I don't know where Stephen A. got his information.
NBA players,
Now they're saying the NBA is leaning towards playing.
It'll be ridiculous.
They're having their meeting at 11 o'clock.
They boycotted. They made a statement. It'd be crazy to end the season. Yeah, let me just quickly say, because you mentioned the other day, Bob, I haven't. I looked for August donations from Richard Contreras, Brian Fuson, Mike Rizzo, Kurt Kuzmowski, Jimmy Lyons, William Vincent, Chuck Durante, Bill Collins Sr., who's 90 years old, sent us $50.
Wow,
John James,
you.
Jeff Witt, Ronald Mills.
This is just to our donate for the show thing,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, these are mostly $5 and $10 donations, but very, very.
That's just really nice. We're going to get to the mailbag, at least for our purposes, a little bit later because we get to talk to Stu Grimson, but I want to lead into the mailbag. Just with a quick thing for Danny. Danny's buddy, Iffy the Dopester, wrote in and said John Bertie of the Marlins stole home against the Mets Tuesday night after a soft toss by the catcher back to the pitcher. He just took off.
Oh, my God.
Danny ever give up a steal of home in his pitching career?
I don't think anybody ever stole home. I don't.
Rod Carew didn't steal home on you?
I don't know. No, listen, I treated him with a lot of respect. He was a 340 hitter, for God's sakes. You know, no, I don't think anybody stole home on me.
Well, guess what?
Because I worked in a real tight stretch position when I had a man on
sure. And guess what? You would be right. But Randy S. Robbins, another listener, tweeted right back, no one ever stole home on Denny McClain, but there were two attempts. Jose Cardinal in 1965, Don Buford 1968.
Yeah, I don't remember either one of them, but
Maybe you threw him out.
I got him, but right? That means they were out.
That's right. It's an attempt.
As they say in Puerto Rico, that was my job, man.
Jeez. Okay, then. But now, folks, I want to tell you about Feldman Automotive. You know, it's Michigan's number one Chevy dealer with five locations, Novi, New Hudson, Lansing, Livonia, and Highland. Feldman, in fact, has nine total, including Feldman Hyundai of New Hudson, Feldman Kia of Novi, Feldman's Dodge, Jeep, and Ram of Woodhaven, and Michigan's top-rated pre-owned supercenter in Waterford, known simply as 1-800-PRE-OWNED. So you buy a fully inspected and guaranteed pre-owned auto from Feldman, then you relax with the exclusive drive it for 3 days, love it, or bring it back guarantee. It's a can't-lose proposition, and now they're also going to guarantee you credit approval. So we're proud and confident that you can find what you need at one of Feldman's nine locations. Let them earn your business. At the same time, you can support our show. You can also buy completely online at FeldmanAuto.com, hassle-free at home or in the showroom. We also want you to consider Power Home Solar. That's America's fastest growing solar energy company. All of Power Home Solar's state-of-the-art panels are made right here in America. With solar energy, you save money. You help save the environment. And you also help avoid those costly and incredibly infuriating power outages. This is because Power Home Solar is now partnered with Generac, the nation's largest provider of in-home backup battery and generator systems. With Power Home Solar's panels and Generac, you're going to be protected by a single, safe, sustainable solution for all your in-home energy needs. Yeah, you lower your energy bills and eliminate power outages forever. Owner Jason Waller and Power Home Solar have financing that just starts at $99 a month. You call them 1-800-POWER-90, and you'll save an additional $1,800. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast.
Okay, let's do the bag.
Got another bulletin for you.
Yeah,
well, right, yeah, because you talked about this earlier in the show. What do you got now?
They're going to resume.
More or less the same thing. It has been postponed tonight. They're going to resume play tomorrow.
Yeah, okay. They're going to figure out how to. They're obviously going to get together the NBA. That is, with the Players Association.
So it's done.
Yeah, be crazy.
Okay, so here we go with the mailbag, folks. And first of all, as always, you can tweet any of the three of us at Eli Zarrett, at MU2Denny, or at Bob Page Sports. And this comes from one of our great followers who, in protest over Eli's always chomping at the bit over the mailbag, actually started a Twitter site called The Not Awful Mailbag. And he writes, newsflash, on today's No Filter Sports, legendary broadcaster Eli Zarrett has declared the No Filter Sports podcast mailbag, quote, award-winning. Right on, Eli. And he also posted a great pic of you, young Eli, on the set of,
oh, really?
As George used to say, news for Detroit. It was always news for Detroit, and he always said, news for Detroit.
I said award-winning, obviously, in quotation marks.
You really misspoke, didn't you?
Yeah, go ahead.
An unnamed friend of Eli's wrote him, and Eli has shared this with us. He says, I've listened to every show. Interviews are the best anywhere, but there's one glaring shortcoming that you need to address. Although COVID and BLM are important parts of stories and deserve to be addressed, all three of you guys seem compelled to continuously share your own opinions on all aspects of both subjects, mostly COVID. I'm not kidding. You guys say the same thing in the same way on every single show. We already know where you stand. Denny's lectures are nauseating. Groundhog Day for regular listeners. This is brutal.
Somebody else in the free world. We want to take their opinion. We don't know what their opinions are.
And not only that, but you have to talk about this stuff, especially Black Lives Matter today.
It is in our society.
Well, put it this way.
Five by five.
That's my friend Pete. And he also wrote us after a Monday show. He goes, really good show Monday, back in the rails. Best example, the first 20 minutes talking about the worst baseball team on the planet, yet all three of you contributed to an interesting discussion. Loved your observation about the literal growth of the Latino players from Chico Fernandez to the present day Abreu types. Pete's one of my best friends, and he comments on every show.
Well, yeah. Tell him to put his computer away.
Yeah. Folks, I got news for you out there. You may not know this, but all three of us here in this program have been ripped before in major headlines in large circulation newspapers. We got a thick skin collectively, and we always like to hear constructive criticism. That's what that was.
Hey, I was called ugly before I got to New York. One of the things, the preliminary things about me, which said, trust me, he's no Ken doll, it said. anyway, are you going to – I know it's too long, but Dom Vitale.
No, I got that right here.
Okay, you're not going to read the whole thing.
No, that was my next story. My next story was, he's like Iffy the Dopester. He's become like a star of the show here in the mailbag, right? And what he does, if you don't know this, is he goes back to our shows exactly a year ago on the date, and he picks out the items that he thought were cool or interesting, and there are way too many to mention here. So I have only three. I have only three from when Daryl Evans joined us, August 26, 2019. He writes, I saw a Lincoln sedan on the road the other day, and Eli's right. Buy a Lincoln. They're sleek and classy. Eli's been saying this for over a year at least. Then he says, Bob and Eli do not understand why ESPN gives WNBA score updates during a real sporting event. And we still don't, Eli.
We still don't. That's right. He's just
and then he closes it. And also on this show, he says, Eli questions Bob's girlfriend on the program about tennis, and she comes through with the right answer. She sounds hot. I'll tell you what, Dom. Then you go live with her. Never live with an attorney. I wake up in the morning and say, hey, honey, it looks like it's gonna be a nice day today. I wouldn't say that. No.
You know,
I see some clouds over there.
I just can't imagine someone living with you. I'm sorry. I can't imagine. Hey, by the way, I've joined the Depression Club. I now have pills for my depression.
Good. Sorry to hear that.
We're kidding. All in it together. Now, here is a guy who only goes by G-A, capital W. And you folks, I've been saddled with a very tough name to spell by my parents. B-O-B. He writes, B. Page needs to stop interrupting everybody. Too much bickering from B. Page whenever Danny McClain is trying to make a point. Also, I take big boy issue with Brandon, who thinks he knows everything. Bulletin, he doesn't. In addition, I do not care what the producer or engineer thinks. Just do your job. Listening to show 169 was very disappointing. After hearing Brandon take the liberty to play a non-show argument between McClain and Page during the recent show, I would have bet you guys would have fired him. He would have been, that'll be the day when Brandon gets fired.
Now, Brandon's not used to criticism. This is not fair. Brandon's not used to criticism.
Well,
have a conversation one day, but not on screen anymore.
All right, next letter. Let's go. Next letter.
Brandon, as Harry Truman said, if you can't stand the heat, stay out of the kitchen. Just don't say anything on the air, okay? He also goes on to say how much he loves the show, and we really do appreciate that. On the continued failings and floundering of the FLs, Chuck Monin tweeted, they've taken a sports genius like Bob Page and driven him away from his boyhood team. Again, the Lions are trash. Now, usually when people put qualifiers attached to my name, they're strictly rated R.
Can we stop calling? Can we please call them the Lions? I got you off Big 13 plus Rutgers.
Now, people love the FLs.
People get where FLs. You are. Let's just call them by their name from now on.
You call them by their name, okay? I'll call them the FLs. So we got website submissions here, asknofilter@gmail.com. Ken B. writes, boy, this is a tough day for all of us. Ken B. writes, I've listened to about 50% of your shows. The Dexter Bussey interview was, very boring. First time I ever gave up on the show before the guest and interview was finished. You're really batting a healthy 900 plus with me, but that was a rough one. Bob spent too much time on the uniform police segment. Dexter was probably a little long-winded with his answer, but, you know, you can't control that. And he says, I'll be listening anyway. Take care. But Al Kopach, for instance, said the Dexter Bussey interview was terrific. I had no idea he was a uniformed policeman after he retired. So you can't win, can you?
That's right.
I really don't know. We get some.
If you're groping, it means we're over. Once you start groping, it's over.
Thank God.
Let's get to our...
Denny spoke too soon about this. Denny never say something like that. Because you know why, Denny? You're clueless. You don't know what's coming up. You don't know what's coming up. And here it is. Unnamed texter at 760-89-BALLS. Last week, I heard three others on your show argue with Denny about a major league debut by Casey Mize. It's obvious who understands a major league debut in that discussion. Please share this with your listeners and remind them that Denny did not have a 6.83 earned run average after his major league debut. And how many home runs did Casey Mize hit in his?
And by the way, I never had a 6.83 ERA ever.
Not even in spring training, right?
Good stuff. Hey, let's get to our feature interview. Stu Grimson, the Grimmer. Let's talk to the Grimmer.
Great guy.
Stu Grimson, enforcer extraordinaire, has written an autobiography with Kevin Allen, that fine Michigan-based hockey writer, titled Stu Grimson, The Life and Career of a Reluctant Warrior. Stu played for seven NHL teams in a 14-year career from 89 to 02, including the Wings from 95 to early 97. Now, if you saw the Bob Probert movie, Tough Guy, you heard Grimson sensitively and eloquently eulogize Probert and his many fights with him. Yet, as you'll hear in this 1990 incident versus Toronto when Grimson was a Blackhawk, you would not think we're talking about the same thoughtful guy.
There's Grimson trying to get loose, and now he's gone crazy.
He's right out of it. Keenan was doing everything he could to hold on to him. Look at him.
This is a man gone mad.
But is he the same guy? Which evidences that the role of enforcer is a very complex one as well. Stu, who was that man gone mad that night 30 years ago? It couldn't be the sensitive man who wrote this book.
No, it was in fact a young misdirected youth who thought that was the best way to deal with a contentious situation on the ice. My mom still hasn't forgiven me for that.
You know, you fought 393 times. I think what's fascinating, though, and maybe people don't know this, and this is why it was so interesting in the book, is that you were really reluctant to take on that role. You were drafted twice and weren't really sure that that's what you wanted to be as a hockey player, to be this enforcer that was so important to the game. And you even went back to college, University of Manitoba, where there was no fighting at all. What was the transformation that enabled you to not only accept this role, but then embrace it and get as good at it as you got?
Well, I think for every young guy that kind of goes through that stage in your career, your development, where, you know, you've got some skills, but maybe don't have the full, you know, repertoire of skills to kind of be that 30, 40 goal scorer, you know, you're asked to play, you're asked to contribute in other ways, especially if you have the physical size and the mental makeup for it. And I was certainly one of those guys. It's a really challenging role to have to play. It's hard on you more emotionally, mentally than it is physically. And for me, I think I kind of went through a maturation process. And that those 2 years that you reference around the time that I was back at the University of Manitoba, that's where I got some time to kind of separate myself from the pro game, from the fighting part of the game. I think grow up a little bit, put it in perspective, and then take a shot at an NHL, a professional hockey career in earnest, having had that 2 years to kind of pause and almost recalibrate, if you would.
And you actually went back to college and became a lawyer, right?
I did. So when I signed my first pro contract, I had not yet completed my undergraduate degree. By the time I finished pro hockey, I had about a year left on my undergrad to complete. I did that at a little school in Nashville called Belmont. And then I went to your point, I went to law school shortly after at the University of Memphis and earned my JD, graduating, I think, around 05, 06, something like that.
Good for you.
Stewie, we don't have time to do all the amazing, unbelievable stories that you write about in your amazing, unbelievable book. But I'll tell you what really struck me, and it rubbed me the wrong way. Now, you're a kid. You're out with a couple of your teammates. You're at a pizza parlor. pizza, come down to the last piece. You just take it. You don't say, hey, does anybody want the last piece? You just take it, and one of your teammates complains about it. So you actually brandish a fork. You threaten him. Then when you're fighting over the pizza, you take this fork across the table, and you stab it hard into his cheek. There's blood going on everywhere. It's disgusting. And you know what I thought, Stu? I thought, here's a guy who was abused physically as a child. Maybe by your stepfather. That was not the case, a Canadian Mountie. What's wrong? What was wrong with you?
Well, you know, I think the explanation can go kind of two ways. Not two ways. It needs two layers. One, boys will be boys, and boys will,
oh,
will
come
certainly
on,
be
Stu.
In boys around this night. And then two, isn't any surprise, we had a few beers in the tank at that point that night. This was late night pizza after a night of kind of crawling the pubs of a little town, Brandon, Manitoba, and it got a little goofy. An ex-teammate of mine, Jeff Lawson, thought that he was entitled to the last slice of pizza. I had a completely different view about that. I warned the man, and he came for that pizza, and I had to bring down the fork.
You know,
boys will be boys, huh? Yeah, I've done that to many of my friends too when I was younger.
I want to get into the wings a little bit later because some of your insights that to Scotty and Steve Eisman and Bob Probert are so right on and so interesting. But I'm still fascinated by your maturation where you could get to the point where you're going to be an enforcer in the NHL and they call you up. You're in 1990, you're still a kid, you're 24, but you've been in the minor leagues for a while. To fight Dave Brown and his fist of renown. It's a fascinating story of you and Brown and what you were feeling, the anxiety you're feeling. Let's listen to some of that fight before you describe the terrible conclusion actually in it. Go ahead, Brandon.
And a fight, Brown and Grimson. And Brown has landed some lefts. Well, we thought this would happen. It didn't take long. And Dave Brown is laying a beating on Stu Grimson.
Now, that was a fight that you lost early in your career and a terrible result. You fractured your orbital bone. And yet, in the book, you describe how it was a metamorphosis for you that didn't discourage you from continuing to be an enforcer. It actually gave you the confidence that you could handle that role. Explain that to us.
Yeah, you know, it sounds really peculiar to say that. And the backstory behind that is this was really my coming to the NHL moment, my welcome to the NHL moment. I knew that if I was going to stick around, the path to the NHL kind of went through my counterpart, my rivals, the Edmonton Oilers. I was breaking in with Calgary. My rival on the other side, a fierce rival, the Edmonton Oilers, was Dave Brown. So all that kind of happened through Brownie, and the second outcome was really the worst. But it kind of goes back to that reluctant warrior piece. I had struggled with that role. And I think, you know, this moment started the process of kind of revealing to me what it was that was holding me back or what made me so reluctant in this role. And it really was the fear, not so much the fear of suffering a loss physically. It was more the fear of humiliation, of coming up short in front of my teammates, my coach, the fans inside the building. That for me kind of started a revelation of sorts around that fear. And I kind of came to the conclusion through a lot of self-talk and some internal reflection, you know, if I can come back from a beating like this, because it really was one of the worst losses a heavyweight enforcer could face, I said to myself, if I can come back from something like this, there really is very little left to fear. If I can yank myself up by the bootstraps, get back into the mix and do what it is I need to do, what then is there left to fear? So it was a pivotal moment for me in my career. And oddly enough, from that moment where a lot of guys would have maybe taken a different course and packed up their bags and called it quits, you know, that was the moment for me where I went on to, you know, get into the NHL full on and, you know, spent 14 years rather playing that heavyweight enforcer role.
With the Grim Reaper and the enforcer, could you have played in the NHL if you weren't the enforcer?
You know, I think there might have been a role for me then. I grew up, and here's the thing. If you take away the role of enforcer, there are no, you know, young aspiring amateur athletes looking to fill that role or ultimately tracking towards that right. goal. So for me, I would have spent more time, you know, focusing on the skill side of the game. And that's not to say it was a guarantee, but there may have been a path for me, because through my junior and collegiate career, you know, there were moments I was a point-a-game guy. I had 25 goals, 50-plus points my final year of junior. So I may have been able to carve out a career of some kind were it not for the enforcer role. But I'll tell you what, my skill set today, even taking the most positive, the most flattering, version of my skill set, I don't play in today's game. No chance. These guys are fast. They're super skilled. They're incredibly creative. And I'll tell you what, side note, the game's in a great place as a result.
Sure, I wanted to follow up on what you're talking about Dave Brown a couple minutes ago. That guy basically caved in your face. In the book, here comes teammate Mark Bureau to visit you in the hospital. He's standing at the door. He takes one look at you lying in your bed, and he breaks down weeping, 15 minutes weeping, while you go over, put your arms around him, and try to comfort him. I almost cried too. How come there were no pictures? How come there were no pictures of you in the book with your face caved in?
Yeah, I don't know. I've lost track of all those. Of course, this isn't, I didn't have an iPhone in my back pocket then. These were the days of, you know, the actual film inside the camera and Polaroid. So I really regret. I had one photo of that I can recall. I have no idea if it still exists, if I were able to find it, but my face was an absolute mess. But the story about Mark Bureau, and we called him Frenchie back then, that really is the more humorous side of a very dark, dark story, which is the loss to Dave Brown. And I often refer to it this way. As you know, Frenchie walked into my room, he saw my face. I mean, I was unrecognizable to myself. I was in really bad shape. He took one look at me, he started crying, and there I am reclining in my hospital bed, and I'm patting his hand. Frenchie, it's going to be okay. Frenchie, I'm going to be okay. I'm the one consoling the healthy teammate. And I often say, it's bad when the hockey players are crying.
You know, Stu, I don't think anybody, not that I've read a lot of hockey books, but I've never heard anybody describe the psychology, the role of the enforcer like you have in this book. Because visually, even for hockey fans, the craziness you see with two guys bare-fisted risking permanent damage for the sake of a game is so hard to understand. We look at them. That's why we call them goons. You're anything but a goon, even though you may have looked it during your, but you explain in the book and do it for our listeners that there's an art to this, when to fight, how to size it up, when to know how to summon the rage that takes you from going from the benches you describe where you're not feeling any animosity, where you're going to have to fight somebody, the fear, the anxiety, the gamesmanship, the how you have to take your elbow pads off. They're really, it's almost like a chess game, as ugly as it looks, to learn how to be an effective enforcer, when to do it, when to lift your team. I thought that was very interesting in the book, and maybe I've explained it, but I'd like you to go further on it.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. I mean, from an enforcer's point of view, nobody's more in tune. Oftentimes you're sitting there and you're monitoring this on your team's bench, but nobody's more in tune with the physical momentum within the context of the game. And if my team is playing flat, if my team hasn't started well, if we're trailing by a goal or two, I sense that there's a moment I can shift the physical momentum. That's when I get an opportunity to be out there in a moment like that. That's what I'm trying to do. That really is today. It remains today one of the purest justifications for the role. It's uncanny. It's a really peculiar thing. It's hard to describe to people, but my anecdotal experience has been 75% of the times I go out there and I get into it with somebody on the other side, and I show well. And sometimes I don't even have to show well. The momentum will shift in the game, and there's an offensive surge of some kind. May not result in a goal, but there's a surge of some kind from my team. And it really comes from this. Everybody else on the bench, and I've seen it, I've experienced with other teammates who step into my shoes and do that very thing. The bench kind of goes collectively, hey, this guy put himself in harm's way because he's willing to suffer, put himself at risk, because it's that important to him. we got to get our game in order. We've got to step it up. We've got to find a way to get things going in the right directions.
You mentioned hockey players in tears. Now, you overstep your boundaries at the end of your career. You go into the coach's office to apologize. I think you're with the LA Kings. You're weeping. You are weeping in your coach's office because you overstepped your boundaries. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I did. There was a situation we're playing in the playoffs. I was a member of the Anaheim Ducks. We had made the playoffs that year. We were game three of the series coming back to our building. We were down two. It was a pivotal moment. We needed to, if we were going to climb back into the series, game three was critical. Somebody, Chris Draper from the Detroit Red Wings, you all remember Chris was a member of the Grind Line back in the day. And Chris Draper was an ex-teammate, but he took a run at my center, Antti Aalto, and I lost control. I reacted in a way that I just shot Chris Draper. It ended up being a four-minute minor, two consecutive minor penalties lasting 4 minutes in total. And the Wings ended up scoring two goals. And really, it ended up being a pivotal moment in the game. And you could sure make the argument that it was a pivotal moment in the series as the Wings went on to win the series overall and eliminate my Ducks. I was beside myself. I'd never been in a situation where I had really negatively impacted my team in that way before. And yeah, I mean, I was the first one that showed at the rink the following day. And I was really emotional as I apologized to Coach Hartsburg for the way I had reacted at that moment. It was, you're there to watch over your teammates. You're there to stick up for your teammates. But when you become a liability, you've crossed
the line.
And that was certainly a moment for me when I did cross that line.
Yeah, let me tell you how we used to do it in baseball, and they still do it to some degree. When before a ball game, we would find out if there was a possibility of having a brawl. Then we would go see one of our friends on the other team and say, listen, if the brawl wakes out tonight, you and I together, we roll around the first baseline and stay out of everybody else's way so we don't get stepped on. So we had a much more gentlemanly fashion than you guys did. But you wore a lot more equipment than we did, too.
Well, wore a lot more equipment, but there was a reference earlier. I mean, these are men, 6'4" yeah, and beyond. These are men, 225 pounds to 265 pounds, with fists of steel, who are capable of crushing human bone. It's and I experienced that firsthand during my career. It's hand-to-hand combat of a different order.
And yet, you still felt that you weren't big enough. You're a mammoth guy.
6'6".
So what you did is you stopped skating in the summertime late in your career. The only thing you did is pound iron. You just lifted weights. And I'm looking at this, really? Just to get bigger and stronger still? Did you ever take steroids? Did anybody else you ever fought in the National Hockey League as an enforcer, did you think they were on steroids? Because it was an arms race.
Yeah, it really was. And that's a great way to describe it. It really was an arms race. When I broke into the NHL, I was 6'6". I was 225-ish pounds. And there really weren't very many players my size. By the time I finished my career, I think there was nearly a player my size, sometimes two, on every roster. And these guys had gone from 230 pounds to, I mean, George Laroque played at 265. Derek Bougard came after me. He played at 265. He was 6'9". I mean, these guys were Megatrons on skates. They were massive. And it really was an arms race. The pointed answer to your question, I never took steroids. I knew there was steroid abuse going on. And my era was the era pre-mandatory substance testing. I knew there were other guys that were doing it. John Kordick, who died tragically,
yep,
years before I ever retired and midway through my career.
He died in 1992.
Yeah, he was fairly well known, fairly well documented that John Kordick was on steroids. I knew there were others out there. I couldn't tell you who those guys were. I really could not to this day.
We got to get into the Wings here because you played two seasons. You were traded before the 95 season along with Mark Farner, a sixth round pick for Mike Sillinger and Jason York. You get here and your chapter on Scotty Bowman. was hilarious because he always confused us. We never really knew what he was saying. Some of the stories you tell about standing right next to him with Dave Lewis, and Scotty tells Lewis what to tell you when you already heard it. You tell another one with assistant coach Barry Smith in the middle of a game. Scotty's looking up in the stands and saying, Barry, find out who's sitting in my seats. He's looking at his pager while, and yet you call him Scotty the Mad Genius. And the other thing you said about him was you had to search for the hidden meaning. He would say things you didn't know where he was going. This was what the media suffered with, too. You'd ask him a question and get an answer that was had nothing to do with it. So playing with Scotty was a revelation. And you played for some great coaches, some crazy ones too, because you yeah. played for Keenan. Tell us about Scotty.
Scotty was he was far and away the most colorful coach I ever played for. And it remains one of the richest stops my entire NHL tour. It was a lot of fun. Scotty gave you a good reason, a great story every day you went down to the rink. There was another story coming out of it. I mean, they really are endless. And I was only with the team for parts of three seasons. But I think one of the most hilarious things was he had this quirk. He would never really speak to you directly. I mean, unless it was just you and him in his office or something like that. He did all his communication through an assistant coach, whoever was closer by. Back then it was Barry Smith or it was Dave Lewis. But I remember one game, we're playing against Toronto, and Ty Domi played for Toronto at that point. And I knew, you know, if we're going to get the better of Toronto, I wanted to get into it with Ty and kind of straighten the physical part of it out. So it ended up my first couple of shifts, maybe late in the first period, I went out and I'm trying to get at Ty. I'm trying to goad Ty into an altercation, into a scrap. The first time I'm not successful. And in doing it, I went way out of position. Like I'm just kind of chasing Ty around the rink, if you can imagine that. Well, I get back to the bench. Scotty's standing directly behind me, and Dave Lewis is standing like three players over from me. And Scotty goes to Dave. Dave, he can't do that. Tell Stewie he can't do that. There's no way he can't do that. And then you know, so that kind of subsides. I'm out there for another turn. I kind of pulled the same stunt again. I get back to the bench. Same scenario unfolds, except this time, Dave, that's enough. Stewie can't play. If Stewie's going to do that, Stewie can't play. Tell Stewie he can't play. It's just like this stuff went on.
I was curious when I was reading that. The lovable little mugger from Windsor is only 5'8". Why would you chase after Ty Domi to try to fight him? You're 6'6".
5'8", but he weighed at 225-ish pounds. He was as heavy as I was, except a lot smaller. And listen, nobody's worried about Ty. Nobody's apologizing for Ty. He held his own in the heavyweight category without question. The man was built like a rectangle. He was a fire hydrant with feet.
Bob Probert was a giant in the game and one of the sweetest guys. Denny and I interviewed him many times on our show. Just the nicest kid. So, and you really bring that out in the book about how the personality of the guy fighting is not necessarily who he was. Let's listen. You fought him 14 times. I think this is one of the early ones. Let's hear part of it, Brandon.
Cavalier picked it off, goes down to freeze it. Now Probert and Grimson drop their gloves. I think the first shift of the game for Grimson, and he and Probert are wrestling, and now Probert just muscling him to the ice. Gets in a couple of short right hands, Probert does. Grimson tries to answer. And now Probert got in another right, and Grimson got in a left, and then they're slugging it out, and Grimson and Probert are just working over one another.
So you fought Probert, and you talk about meeting him early in the book, you know, or early in your career. He was cocaine-fueled, and he was, for some reason, a better fighter when he was on drugs than when he wasn't. We always felt that. Tell us about Proby, and does he fit the kind of the mold of what enforcers like you were? Sensitive guys in many ways, but just played this role.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. I got to know Bob after he and I both retired from the game. We were actually part of a goodwill tour that went over to visit the Canadian troops back in, I think this was 2006 or 2007-ish. I might be off by a year. Yeah. But that was back, if you recall, when the armed forces, the international coalition, went into Afghanistan. We went over to visit the Canadian troops. And I got to know Proby really well. you know, the similarities between us, just they're chock full of you know, different attributes that he and I share. But, you know, back to his on ice, his playing career, his on ice persona, and maybe off ice persona to some degree, I think he was really one of the most unique players. To think that you could be, you know, equal parts heavyweight enforcer and really for most of his career the champion of the heavyweight enforcers, and then a guy that was capable of nearly 30 goals, played in the top six really on just about every team, every iteration of the Wings or Blackhawks that he played for. He was so unique, a mix of player. I don't know that there'll ever be one like him. Tom Wilson comes very close, but again, it's kind of hard to compare that because today is a different game. But I think Bobby was a very unique individual, a real boon to any team that he played for. And every time I fought him, and nobody fought him more than me, and there's nobody he fought more than he did me going back the other way, those 14 times, you knew you had your hands full every time because he was equally skilled, equally tough with both hands. It was, you know, it was kind of like, you know, trying to push back a tidal wave as it kind of came towards you.
With all the hits,
but a great,
that you took,
great pro.
With all the hits that you took and with all the hits that you gave as the Grim Reaper and the Enforcer, did you bring any injuries out of the game? Is there something still bothering you? Like when I pitched, I still have a torn rotator cuff. You got any bad injuries from playing and whacking?
Concussions,
and
maybe, yeah.
Of course, that's why he had to retire.
Yeah.
Concussion.
Yeah, I left the game due to post-concussion syndrome. And I had post-concussion syndrome. I battled the symptoms for a good year and a half in the aftermath of walking away the game. But, you know, I blew out a knee. I had all kinds of fractures through the hand and the fingers. Of course, you know, scrapes, cuts, yeah, lacerations all over the place. But I will say, I honestly, if you were to follow me around on an average day today, I lead a really normal life. I don't deal with any lingering problems to this day. I consider myself very fortunate. For all the, you know, for all the crap I put myself through, I leave the game today really, really intact.
Good for you. And yet you look at guys like Pat LaFontaine and Eric Lindros, who were not fighters, who had such horrible problems with concussion, depression, suicidal thoughts. Are you worried about your future, that this might come back to haunt you?
You know, I am. I took my share of licks, and I played in an era when, you know, one, the definition of concussion was very different from what it is today. And the fact or trainer medical staff intervention wasn't near where it is today. And players didn't self-report in a way that they do today. And I applaud those players for that. I think it's one of the important changes that needs to come to the sport. So I do. I took my share of licks, and I do have concern about what my 60s and 70s will look like. But I am encouraged by this. You know, I left the game a good long while ago. I'm probably looking at, you know, 20 years post-retirement nearly now, and substantially mentally intact. I don't know that I deal with anything that my dad didn't deal with at this stage of his life. And, you know, I eat a healthy diet. I get lots of exercise. I take care of myself, and I think that's an important part of it.
I have one last question, and I want it because it's part of a story. And by the way, we've told maybe 10 stories in the book. There's 1,000 in there, and you're going to want to read this book. But you come to Detroit. There's a three-part story, and I want to remind you of all three parts. You're at a restaurant, and you overhear somebody after the trade. And then later on in the conference final against Chicago, down a goal, for whatever reason, Scotty put you in the game. Now, by the way, Stu only scored 17 goals in a 14-year career, but Scotty puts him into the game. So discuss the restaurant, the game, and then what Osgood said to you afterwards. I think it's a terrific story. Go ahead.
I appreciate you bringing that up. I got traded at the trade deadline, 94-95. It was the first lockout year. So I got traded right at the deadline, and Scotty had actually picked up Vladislav Fetisov at the same time. Different trades, separate transactions altogether, but, you know, he was kind of assembling that Fab Five, the Russian guys, at the same time. So we're in the playoffs. I can't recall who we were facing. It might have been San Jose, and it was kind of between games two and three. We had just played game two. We were going to transition back to – no, back up. It was Chicago. It was Chicago. We were playing Chicago. And again, and the memory is substantially intact, guys. Take my word for it.
95 conference finals.
So we were transitioning from, we had just finished off two games in Chicago. We were going to go back to, Detroit. We were going to go back to Chicago for a couple of games. And I had been out to dinner with my wife and my oldest daughter at a restaurant. And it was right after, I think, game two. We're sitting at a restaurant, and I could hear over my the back of my shoulder, I could hear some people talking hockey at the table behind us. And my ears pricked up when my name was mentioned. And I heard this individual who was, you know, a couple of feet from me, obviously didn't know I was sitting at the table next to him. And he said, I really like some of the changes that Scotty has made, getting that Fatis off for a low draft pick. That just makes really good sense. He says, but the one thing I can't understand, why on earth would you go out and get Grimson? Why would you get Stu Grimson? Does that make any sense at all? I looked at my wife. I said, did you just hear that? So long story short, we paid our bill, and I figure I'm going to give this guy, you know, I love to get a reaction from people. So I get up, I put my suit jacket on, and I make a big production of putting my suit jacket on, standing right in front of this guy's table. And so there's no, you know, there's no mistaking, oh my gosh, that's Stu Grimson. He's standing right here at our table. He recognizes me. I lean forward. I said, appreciate your comments about hockey and about the team. And here's the thing. I'm going to do my level best to make sure this was a good trade for you, my friend. He had no idea what to say. Fast forward, game three, we're down a goal. It's midway through the game. And this is a time when I am just not accustomed to playing. But Scotty decides he's going to shake it up. Tim Taylor, Grimson, get out there. He throws us over the boards. He puts us out there with Keith Primo, my longtime friend and teammate, a couple of different stops. So me, Primo, and Taylor are out there. I'll make it the quick version. We end up scoring a goal. I get a great feed from Taylor, and I put it between Eddie Belfour's legs, tie up the game. We go on to win the game. It's a pivotal moment in the series. I'm standing there dumbfounded behind the net. I mean, I was celebrating on my knees because the way this goal takes place, it kind of, you know, I collide with the end boards. I'm like stupefied. Keith Primo comes along, congratulates me. I'm still down there. It's like, Stu, we need to get back to the bench. Like, let's, you know, enough already. Game needs to go on. I get back to the bench, and Chris Osgood is our backup goaltender at the time. I get back to the bench. I'm sitting on the bench. Ozzie, he's got this dry, really dry sense of humor. He's a quiet guy for the most part, and when he does speak, it's usually something hilarious. So he leans over to me, because I've told these guys the story from two nights before already. He leans over to me, goes, great goal, Stu, great job. What do you think that guy at the restaurant is thinking right now?
Well, we sure want to thank you for joining us today. You've been terrific. Thank you very much.
Grimmer, as they
my pleasure, guys.
Great book, The Grim Reaper, The Life and Career of a Reluctant Warrior. Stories galore. If you're a hockey fan, it's a must read. Thanks a lot, Stu. And good
Thanks,
luck
Stu.
Have a great day.
My pleasure. Thanks for giving the book a little treatment. I appreciate the conversation.
You deserve the praise. It's an amazing
book. It's a really great book. And we don't give out praise lightly. Thanks again.
Thank you.
All right.
So anyway, you know, the one question that everybody wanted to hear from Stu is one he's been asked a million times. Who is the toughest guy you ever fought?
Oh, we didn't ask him.
I'll just read from the book what he said. He said, I put fighters into two classes, reluctant warriors and contract killers. Joey Koser was a contract killer. He had a right hand that landed like artillery shells. And then he goes on to talk about Dave Brown, and then he'll mention Probert. So as far as Stu Grimson goes, it's got to be Dave Brown, Joey, and then Proby.
That's a fair way to rank them, no question.
Well, Stu's still with us. That's great.
That's all right, man.
That's what's so great about Zoom.
Hey, Stu, we may need some fill-in help sometime soon here. You want to come on? You know anything about anything else but hockey?
I don't think we can afford him.
Happy to do it. Right, thanks, guys. It's a pleasure to be on with you. Pleasure to be on.
Right. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
All right, so we'll be back Monday, and we will see you all again in another edition of No Filter Sports.
Have a great weekend. We'll